nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
So it's a real pleasure to be here at Purdue. I was here, I think, last fall, and it's really, after digging in and doing some diligence, I think I'm even more excited now than I was then. So today, I'm going to tell you about, and since it's being recorded, I'm going to apologize in advance if I lose a slide because I chopped one or two out that I couldn't show publicly. But today I'm going to show a large amount of data that we've never really talked about before. And it really, rather than look back at what we've done legacy, I really want to look forward to the things that really make me excited about potentially joining you here. And so if you look, Miko probably was kind in his introduction. But if you look broadly at what we've published and what we've done in the last 10 or 15 years, it looks maybe a little random, okay? And I can assure you in our mind that it's not. But if you look collectively at the work, we're really taking what I call a retrosynthetic approach to materials design. And that probably is legacy from me being a classically trained organic chemist. But really, what we're trying to do across all the platforms we're working in is really develop what we call translationally relevant chemical methods that allow you to place bioactive materials or drugs onto degradable polymers. Okay? And if you look on the left here, these are some of the clinical areas that we're working at and unmet medical needs. And basically that's how we raise money, right? So we talk about things like segmental bone defect repair. We'll talk a little bit about that at the beginning of the talk today. CMF reconstruction and craniofacial 3D printing. We'll talk a little bit more about that. But some of the other areas we're working on very collaboratively with other groups around the country are in peripheral nerve defects. We've got a really exciting program going with Rebecca Willits, my colleague, that's NIH and NSF funded in peripheral nerve defect repair, taking advantage of some of these same strategies. Vascular engineering, more recently drug delivery, which I won't be able to talk about in hernia repair. But at its core, from a very basic science perspective, we're still doing the same kind of things that we set out to do a decade ago. And we're looking at things like molecular recognition. We're looking at things like catalyst design and small molecule synthesis. And I think that's allowed us to be nimble in some of these areas where we've really been able to create creative partnerships that have stood the test of time. If you want to break it down a little more programmatically into the kind of things we're looking at, these are just a few of the things we've published in the last few years. Today we're going to talk quite a bit about resorbable resins for 3D printing and vat photopolymerization, which is a big gap from what people want to talk about and do to actually what they're able to do today. We've done a lot with resorbable elastomers. Some of this work will come out probably in the next 30 days that we're pretty excited about. But you'll see a common theme is, except for the, with the exception of the functionalized TPUs for medical devices, everything else here is degradable polymers. And I think that's the common theme that runs through here. And today, at least in the first third of the talk or so, we're going to talk probably about the idea that I had when I first moved to the University of Akron 10 years ago, not in 2014, 2009. I wish I was that young, but that's not the case. And these are amino acid-based polyesterureas. And probably the legacy for this was the work I did with Joachim Kohn when I was at NIST and looking at some of his tyrosine-derived polycarbonates and the premise of using amino acids as building blocks for actually making degradable polymers. It's not the easiest thing to do, but I think you'll appreciate here some of the simplicity in the landscape. So if you look at alpha amino acids here in red, we've used 18 of the 20 naturally occurring. We've got about a dozen non-canonical amino acids. And those can be bridged together with any number of linear or branched diels. We've used sugars, we've used drugs, you name it. It's kind of all the same and designed for specific applications. But those are connected with urea bonds, similar to the way you do an interfacial polycondensation to make, if you wanted to make a ballistic polycarbonate. What's been exciting here is that there's a very strong hydrogen bonding network that builds up, which really provides some interesting properties. That's also historically made them very difficult to work with. So we weren't the first group to report these. These were actually reported, this class of materials, in the late 90s, but almost nothing happens because these are very, very difficult to solution process. But fortunately, I was at the University of Akron and actually learned something about melt processing and very early on recognized that if you actually could melt process some of these materials, that's the way pharma and industry would rather process them anyway. Now, when they degrade, they degrade very similar to degradable polyesters, but unlike degradable polyesters, where you're actually generating acidic units that build up over time, limited by resorption characteristics, you're buffered by the urea every repeat unit. And so it's not quite the conjugate pair that you'd expect over time. And we've been now in five different species and almost 3,000 animals, and we've never seen inflammation in this class of materials. This buffering effect really is a unifying hypothesis that I think will make these materials interesting for the applications we're targeting. The nice thing is when they degrade, you get amino acids, carbon dioxide, and diols, and the terminal oxidation product of those diols. And depending on the side chain and the length of this, you can see that there's a massive potential space. And I think that's reflected in a paper where we published maybe a year ago. So if you just look at Young's modulus versus glass transition temperature, here's five different amino acids, four natural and one non-canonical, and four different linear diols. And so as the diol gets longer, you're basically just diluting the urea unit. But you can see you go from everything to room temperature TG to very stable from a few megapascal all the way up to 2.5 gigapascal, which is basically 40-50% stronger than what you get from most unfilled degradable polyesters. And so big landscape. These are just 20 materials. We've probably got almost 150 in the library, not counting stoichiometric ratios and mixtures. And so remembering that I'm in the College of Engineering this morning, I've got a few bad photos. And if engineers sometimes have soft stomachs, so if you have a soft stomach, you should just close your eyes and hum for a few minutes. And so really what we're looking at with these class of materials is trying to fill unmet medical needs. And one of the reasons I left NIST was because I saw some of these injuries live at Walter Reed, and NIST would not let me work on these things. And so I said, budget for my replacement. And 4 months later, I was at the University of Akron. And so this is a segmental bone defect. This is what happens to an arm hanging out of a Jeep that's hit with an improvised explosive device. And in about 2009, this was not an infrequent injury. This is a small and a large caliber gunshot wound. And this is, clinicians have had solutions, or what they're calling functional solutions for these, since these injuries have happened, right? And so they've had Elizaroff apparatus around since the late 60s. They work, they're slow, people are turning green, so I'll move on for a minute. So I won't go back there, but there are clinical solutions to some of these, but they're not functional. Many of them are not functional. And, you know, if you have to face an amputation and you're 18 or 19 or 22 years old, even 32 years old, it's not a great solution. Okay. And you might say, well, that's a really small population. Probably the surrogate population in the civilian world is this non-ossifying carcinoma that you find in a lot of adolescent girls, where you get a benign non-malignant tumor that basically comes in and eats away the bone. And so if you look nationally, these statistics are now getting old. There's about 2 million bone graft procedures a year, and critical size defect is one that won't heal on its own without some type of surrogate implant put there. Either you have to shorten the limb or pack it with bone graft. And this is a fibia and a tibia in a lower leg, and this is what's considered a large one that resulted in amputation. This is a smaller one that you could actually save. And this is not an infrequent incidence. In fact, this happened to my niece in her femur about 5 years ago, and they found out she had it when she was running and actually fractured her leg playing soccer. And because both her parents are physicians and recognized something was wrong, she didn't lose her leg, but you would imagine that over about 2 years she had four different surgeries with every kind of bone graft packed in there, autograft and allograft that you would imagine. Again, those things are non-structural. Okay, so they had plates and screws. And the hard part about an adolescent girl that doesn't like to be slowed down is not necessarily having that hardware put in, it's digging that hardware out 2 or 3 years later. They actually had to go in a chisel and a grinder and grind it out. And so what we're looking at here and what the really unmet need is to actually, could you develop a polymer construct that without any hardware or glue could stabilize a defect like this, allow it to grow back under some means, and then disappear so that you wouldn't have to go back and dig in the hardware. And so for the tissue engineering community for a long time, and even the medical community, they've laughed at that premise, because if you go back and look at what I learned in bone biology from Richard Gelberman, who was the chair of orthopedic surgery at WashU at the time, if from a surgical perspective, you only need two things for a bone fracture to heal. You need absolute rigid fixation, which for polymers for a long time has been the problem. And the other thing you need is vasculatures and blood supply. Okay, and so for those maybe not so inclined, the blood supply that keeps your bones healthy does not come from the marrow. It comes from the periosteal membrane that actually surrounds most bone-forming mammals. The problem with polymers, and resorbable polymers in particular, is that if you look at the time scale of this fracture healing timeline, after initial fracture, if it's not displaced, in a couple of days you'll form a hematoma. That hematoma will begin to resorb. You'll get a soft callus that forms. Then over time, that resorption process forms in a hard mineralized callus. Now, in a normal healthy adult, this occurs over about 5 weeks. To get a large polymer, especially in a degradable polyester, which has been used and available, again, for years and years, The challenge has been is that those materials swell and they start to lose rigid fixation. And when you lose rigid fixation, you'll start to have non-unions. And when they degrade, they'll generate acidic byproducts. And if the construct is small, like you get in a rat and a rabbit, that's fine. The metabolic systems of those run higher than humans, and so those products are resorbed. But if you get into large constructs, dogs, sheep, humans, where you need volume sufficient in that polymer to support the mass, pretty soon you swamp the vasculature or lymphatic system. And at that point, you'll get the autoacidosis that they suffer from, and this is why these tend to fail in the clinic. And so the paradigm is that, and the reason that degradable polymer has been waived off for this type of application many years ago, and it was really challenging when we got started with this project, is that the conception in most surgeons' mind and most reviewers' mind, at the NIH especially, was that no polymer that was resorbable could maintain rigid fixation for the time that was needed and then ultimately degrade. But we ignored all that against our better advice and really moved forward. And much of this was enabled by a really critical partnership that evolved just by happenstance. And so, again, I've got three children. My daughter broke her arm twice, one summer, one each. That's what happens when you have two older brothers. But the chief of orthopedic surgery at Children's Hospital in Akron, which is the fifth or sixth largest in the country, his son is actually Brad Weiner, who's the head of spine surgery at Houston Methodist. And so Brad was home for Christmas, and Denny, who I'd happened to meet, Denny Weiner, who's the chief at Children's, over time we had met over a couple of beers and talked about polymers. Well, Brad had a large DOD contract with Ennio Tassiotti, who's the head of nanomedicine under Mauro Ferrari at Methodist, and they'd been working on bone putty with every kind of polymer you could have ever dreamed of, and it had failed. And so they'd burned through about $10 million, and the DOD finally had run out of patience when Brad showed up at my door. And their model for their surgery was this. This is a sheep, and other than the jokes, this is a knee, or this is a hip, this is a lower, what would be considered a femur, here's the knee. And the reason the military uses the sheep model is because, one, they have the same amount of cortical cancellous bone as humans, they have a very similar vasculature and healing time rate, but they're also bad patients. And most of the time, if it works in a sheep, they can get it to work, translate in a human, most of the time, because most humans are better patients. But what they'd like to do is they actually have a synthetic tube that they would actually stabilize the bone. It could be ultimately packed with growth factors or collagen, you name it. But what it would provide was a rigid fixed source that would maintain that physiology locally and actually allow the animal to ambulate, and we'll talk about that in a minute, while the bone regrew. Okay, so they had been through esters and fumarates and you name it. Everything failed until they came to us. And the reason for that, I think that our material was different, is unlike many of the semi-crystalline degradable polyesters that were out there, when they were fabricated into a structure like this, be it injection molding or casting or solution, during that drying process where you've got boundaries between amorphous and crystalline domains, when you put 3 or 4 point bend stress on those or torsional stresses, you get grain failures. Now, the one thing that I didn't tell you about in the previous slide is these, because the urea groups are strongly hydrogen bonding, so they actually are almost totally amorphous. And so they're beautiful to injection mold, they're beautiful to extrude, and you don't get the kind of point defects you get between grain boundaries. They're actually, this is some of the simplest chemistry we do, it's almost embarrassing to call this chemistry, but you take an alpha amino acid under acidic conditions to prevent amidation. You can condense any diol. Here's a linear. We've got a couple of different chains. This is 3, 4, 5 to actually dilute that urea group. You make the bisdiamino diester, and then using interfacial or bulk methods, this is triphosgene. You can also use phosgene. Polymerize in situ in a classic step growth polymerization to yield a polyester urea. You can see as you start to dilute that urea group, the glass transition in turn drops. And so here we go from 3 to 50, and in fact, using any number of amino acids and diols, you can monitor from about 3 or 4 degrees up to about 80 or 90 C quite easily. The exciting thing here, and it's probably not so easy to recognize, is that one, we can make large batches of this if you've got a large enough reactor. But the TD, which is the degradation temperature of the polymer, is more than 200 degrees above the glass. And so you have a massive processing window for these materials, which has been very advantageous over time. Just to give you a brief indication of are the materials strong, this is an engineering stress strain curve here where you're looking at stress and strain. Again, the black is the short chain, 1,6 diol, 1,8, 1,10, 1,12. And you can see, as the TG drops, you'd get a yield point, as you'd expect, and fracture at only a few percent. But this is still a few percent more than you'd get in a glassy material. And so without any exotic, and this is about 4 or 5 years old now, few percent strain, you end up with a Young's modulus of about 2.5 gigapascal. But that's more of an academic exercise. Would it actually work in practice? And so again, when we sat down with DARPA's program manager at Methodist and looked at what they actually wanted to do, it was a much more daunting task than actually trying to design for an engineering stress strain. They wanted to take somebody off the battlefield in the Middle East, fly them to Germany, make sure they didn't die, do a CT scan. And when they finally got them to Texas, San Antonio, or Walter Reed, actually be able to do a single surgery with no external fixation. The only thing you could use is polymer and glue, so no rods and pins and screws like you've seen in these complex fractures. They wanted it tailorable to heights and bone structure, which I thought would be much more challenging than it is, and we'll revisit that in a minute, and totally resorbable, but the key part of that is they didn't care how long. Okay, and so the paradigm for tissue engineering has been that the material has to go away at the same rate that the bone forms. Okay, and that's true if you put it between and try to actually grow bone through a scaffold, okay, because it needs to get out. And then the second half of my talk, I'll show you that, where that's interesting. But if you work around that and actually structure the framework to actually not grow the bone through, but actually just support the fixation, that's not true at all. Okay, and fundamentally, it's nearly impossible to have something resorb at the same rate bone is forming and not lose rigid fixation. They wanted it to maintain structural integrity for 6 months, okay, and it had to be simple because most orthopedic surgeons, if you've ever been in the OR, are really butchers, and it's no secret why you're sore when they're done, but they use hammers, saws, and chisels. And so you'll see this is our 6-inch extruded tube. This was model one that we developed 4 or 5 years ago now. It's about 1 inch inner diameter. You've got 4 or 5 millimeters thick of polymer, and there's no porosity here. And you might say, well, that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard if I've ever read a tissue engineering book. But if you look back at what's actually in a bone, and this ignores the microvasculature, this is a cross-section of a human femur with the marrow pulled out, and really the primary element is structural, right? The marrow provides immune and different biological functions, but the blood vessels that support this, again, come from the periosteal membrane. Okay, so if you just look at rigid fixation, if you could actually fixate a bone with a degradable polymer and then do other things to actually encourage the regrowth, then maybe you wouldn't have to suffer the same fate with the predictable degradation while trying to maintain rigid fixation. And so we did some pilot work with this, and we thought we had a shot. But really, when we went back in for $6 million more dollars, the DoD said you needed a commercial manufacturing partner. And so for the better part of the last 8 or 9 years, I've been really fortunate to work with Cook, both Cook Medical and Bloomington and Cook Biotech here in town. And so we went to every, and so what the DoD's requirements were, you need an American company who had medical products on the market who would make this for us and label it with their label. And we went to every orthopedic company in North America, and they sent us away laughing. But I'd worked quite a bit with Cook over the years, and Kim Hawkins, who was the chair at the time, said if the DoD wanted it, Cook would make it and slap their label on it. And so this would not have happened without them. And thankfully, they've really backed that with their resources. And why we have a really nice patent on this that just issued in December, Cook actually really put their engineering muscle to work here. So we had been in an extruded process that was somewhat inefficient, and we actually went to an injection molded process where you're actually able to control the surface finish and actually the internal struts. And so now there's internal struts on this injection molded product that prevent torsion. Okay, and so I say that because it wouldn't have happened without Cook's help, and it takes companies like that if you really want to do big things. Now, is it strong? So this is the real test of strength. So rather than a stress strain curve, this is my first student, Faye, actually standing on the side of one of these tubes. So Faye weighed about 70 kilograms. I, unfortunately, weigh about 100 kilograms. And I can stand on it as well, and anyone here in the room certainly could as well. It takes about 2,500 pounds in a four-point bend test to fracture this, okay? And that's stronger than any sheep can kick. And this, some of this three-point bend test is done by Mike Moreno at Texas A&M. But how it ultimately works is just as designed. And so if you look at the preoperative x-ray on the left, we're going to make a lateral incision here in the periosteum on the inner side of the sheep's leg so they can't scratch it. and actually cut out 3 centimeters of bone. You see here in Brad's hand, the shell, and then it goes together like Legos. And so you put one in, you glue it, you pack the inside with decellularized collagen or decellularized horse tendon in the initial studies, and then you basically pull out at 90 degrees. I don't show that photos because engineers really don't like that. And then it goes together much like Legos, and you glue it. You stretch it under fluoroscopy, you glue it. You see here we had to throw in a couple of phantoms, but basically you can see the glue, and you can't see the shell under fluoroscopic x-ray because it has the same scattering length density as human tissue. It's carbon, nitrogen, hydrogen, oxygen. We've got iodinated versions now, but for all intents and purposes, here you see a glued shell bridging the gap, about a 2-inch gap, between that defect. Now, the last criteria the military wanted, which was really key, was they wanted the patient, in this case the sheep, out of bed and on their feet in a 50% weight-bearing capacity in 72 hours or less. Because most of the humans injured in this particular application die not of the wound, but actually of depression, right? And so it's a huge challenge. And we were fortunate that 8 hours post-operative, the sheep was able to actually stand up in a splint. 4 weeks later, they take the splint off. The sheep runs around the field in College Station, Texas. Here's the one-month x-ray, and you see a mineralized compound, actually a callus formation, around the outside of the shell. You can see the individual H here. You've got a little displacement because the sheep was smaller than we thought. Not a lot growing here. At 4 months now, you see that mineralized callus. Again, you haven't quite bridged the gap. But the normal plate and screw, you get nothing. Okay? If that manifests itself over time and you start looking at the cross-sectional MRI and CT, these are the original cut marks here in blue. This is all new cortical bone, and then you've got mineralized callus around. And at 4 months, you've lost about 40% of the original volume of the shell. And if you look at the histology here, it's a little with the lighting, it's a little tough. You've got the periosteal membrane, which is critical. This looks like the normal physiology of the callus. You see here, this is the original glue mark that's fractured. But it looks like there's a fibrotic layer eating the shell from the outside in. And so what we found over time, and I won't belabor the point to convince you that this is a surface eroding material, is that under the right conditions, you can actually predict resorption with time. But functionally, it works great. And so I show this slide.
If you pull the virus capsule, it still
degrades. Yep.
How does it degrade when you have a capsule around
it? It's not dense enough to present to wall it off. And so if you actually look at the capsule density and the fibrotic density, what you get with a breast implant versus this is much less. And so this is still a vascularized fibrotic layer. And so if you go in and actually look at osteoblasts, osteoclasts, and the macrophages, they're still there. We're in a breast implant capsule, they're excluded. So I show this data. This is actually Mike's, where you see they actually, the biomechanics study. This is the most expensive study that I've ever done. This person gets paid a lot that trains the sheep how to walk across here, and hopefully this will work. But actually they walk across and strike, and so this is the only measurement that the military cared about, because for them, this was the evidence of functional recovery. Could the sheep, with the open gap, walk across the strike plate and actually strike it with the same gait and force as they did prior to the injury? And the fact is, here, they can. And so if you look at the preoperative strike versus 1 month versus 4 months, you see that it's almost indistinguishable. And if you look at the hind limb waveform, again, unless you had a really analytical eye, if the sheep was walking, it's very difficult to tell which leg they did the surgery on. And so this has been really an exciting launch point for us and got us thinking about lots of applications. The studies currently, we're waiting on more material and more shells in a third generation, but we're gearing up now for what will be 50 more sheep that will initiate hopefully this spring, because it's been far too long and too many injuries to see that ongoing. Now, one of the things that got us thinking about this particular hypothesis, especially as we advanced through these other animal models, it was, where was the inflammation? And while we're still trying to prove that's a neutralization effect, like I said, we've been in many, many other animals, 3,000 animals in 5 different species, and not seen inflammation. And so these are just a few of the other areas where we're currently working with polyesteureas. We're doing 3D printing with FDM-based methods. This is a segmental bone defect work. Injection molding, we've done a lot with shape memory. We're doing now a lot with shape memory intestinal stents and deployment, where I think that'll be quite interesting. We've done a lot of work, and have quite a few proposals pending with tissue-engineered vascular grafts and also wound healing. But what's really enabled this is that massive processing window and the lack of crystallinity that really so many other materials suffer from. What it also got us thinking about is there's so many other opportunities rather than really narrow military applications for new materials. And so I've got one more bad photo here. But if you want to start thinking about patient-specific anatomically correct printing, so instead of this crude shell, which serves a purpose, but in fact is pretty crude relative to what you might imagine doing, could you actually start designing complex shapes? And this soldier's been, this is a nose, this has been shot in the chin, this is what's left of its teeth, and so could you actually rebuild a jaw? Okay. And probably what's changed most in my independent career is the availability of imaging at a price. So when I was at WashU, micro CT and MRI was so expensive that it could only be reserved for the most exotic cases. Now, $200 you can get a medical grade CT without too much trouble. And so there's been a huge accessibility in imaging. And what most of the industry has been focused on in 3D printing is actually taking that image and converting it to a digital design. There's lots of ways to do that. That's what's also preventing products from actually coming to market, because that particular black box is what's undercut most of the FDA's design history file process, where things are based on evidence or trial-based advances. Once you have a digital design, any number of print machines can convert it to a print code, and that actually print with high fidelity. But the gap here has been it only really works when the optimal materials are available. And so the chicken and the egg problem has really been in materials availability. Now, 3D printing is not new. It's just now accessible to people that can actually play with it, right? So, you know, even 15 years ago at NIST, I think I spent $800,000 of taxpayer money on a gel printer that basically does the same thing that a $400 maker bottle do now, okay, with almost the same resolution and lots less shear stress. And I think when I left NIST 10 years ago, I put a piece of tape on the on switch, and I think the last time I was there doing neutron scattering last fall, it's still there. So it's got to be easy, it's got to be accessible, but it's got to generate the kind of structure that you want. Many of these methods have been around since the 60s, especially 60s and 70s, especially inkjet printing. But what we're really excited about, mainly because of the resolution that's available, is what you can do with stereolithography and photochemical printing. In starting companies and thinking about this translationally, there's been a tremendous amount of pushback in that nothing's out there on the market. And in fact, there's more than 100 devices, and I think it's about 108 now, that have actually been approved by the FDA for use in humans in the United States. And that's about 50% less than what's available in Europe, who's been much more accessible here. Probably the biggest money makers, so the big dreams are on the top, the big money makers on the bottom. So the actual recovery of cost for patient-matched surgical guides is actually almost becoming standard of care at academic medical centers. The most money out there is the dentists. The dentists are making money on this. And if you look at companies like 3D Systems and Carbon, half of all their revenue is now in dentistry, even though Carbon's only been in that market for about 6 or 8 months. You look at printed metals, Stryker Pseudo custom knee and spinal cages. Okay, there's many examples of these out there, with the exception of the cranial caps. Most of these I wouldn't call necessarily patient-specific, but the point is that the regulatory process to actually march these through the clinic and into the commercial pipeline are there. The other pushback you get, and that it's so slow, fine, that it's irrelevant commercially. And I would argue again that the case for this has already been made. And so I've had the good fortune of working with David Dean, who actually convinced me to start working in this area about 5 years ago. David Dean was at Case Western Reserve. He's a physiologist. He'd been in plastic surgery and neurosurgery. David was actually the first person to take 3D printed parts to the FDA in 2005. And this is a paper in Journal of Craniofacial Surgery with him and Bob Ratchison, who was the chair of neurosurgery at Case at the time. And this is 2003, so this isn't a misprint. This is a long time ago, 15, 16 years ago. The result of 200 human patients where they had done polymethylmethacrylate-based skull implants, patient-specific in humans in neurosurgery at Case. And the argument they made at the time, and these have been revisited now, so prior to the 3D printing, if you had a hole in the head from a gunshot or whatever else, and you had a large section of their skull missing, you've obviously got to put it back. This was about a 14-hour surgery, involved 3 different surgeons, a whole army of nurses and support staff. And at the time, at Cleveland Clinic and Case, just to stand in the OR required about $150 to $300 a minute. That's not the doctor cost. That's not the device cost. That's not the drug cost. That's not physician fatigue. That's occupying space. Very, very expensive over 14 hours. Now, even though it takes 6 or 8 hours to print something of this size under the best conditions, in a preoperative case, because if someone has a hole in the head, the first thing they're not going to do is put a bone back. You've actually got time to address this. And so you can take a CT. You can actually predict what it is. This is a sterilized PMA implant. This is a model of the skull. This is a polyurethane surrogate that the surgeon can play with. This type of reconstruction can be now done in less than 90 minutes. Okay, and so if you do the economics on that, the device could be $100,000, and you'll never exceed the cost of what it cost when it was 14 hours. Okay, and so the market for this is there, but you can't compare apples to apples. And so the key part now is, although PMMA is not resorbable, but what instead of having a plastic plate in your head, you actually wanted to grow the skull back? Well, you can do that if you've got the right material. And the challenge here is that the materials have not been available. And again, it's a chicken and egg problem. So if you look up MakerBot or any of these other 3D printing companies, what they have in the degradable space are basically three materials. They've got lactic acid, every copolymer of glycolic acid or caprolactone. Because they're around, there's supply chains, they exist. You can buy sterile materials, you can buy GMP materials, you name it. If you want a new material, you've got a chicken and egg problem, because a company won't commercialize a polymer without a market, and there's no market until something's actually available. And so it's a very big risk proposition. Most of these things can be extruded. They are being extruded. They're being used. Some have been used in special exemption cases, especially Scott Hollister's work in pediatric patients when he was at Michigan and now at Emory and Georgia Tech. But if you want a true degradable polymer that might work in vat photopolymerization, okay, that has been a huge gap. And so probably most of what's been going on, at least commercially, that you see in the press releases from things like J.P. Morgan Chase and such, well, people would like to do photopolymerization on these structures. Great features, can be done fast if you look at what carbon's doing. But all of those things out there are mostly methacrylate-based, and those essentially aren't resorbable. And so one of the areas that we looked at very early on, David had worked with Tony Mikos and John Fisher for years on polypropylene fumarate. And for this, and for us, this was a really peculiar problem. And so if you look at the literature, what's been done with polypropylene fumarate, there's about 1,500 papers. They've done everything from stem cell studies and basic science all the way through sheep. The military, DOD collectively, has put about $40 million just into PPF. And they've never had a human trial. And the question is really why? Well, a couple of things. One, this was the first material really designed by Tony to degrade into non-toxic resorbable byproducts. So you get propylene glycol and fumaric acid. It's only photoprintable at less than 3,500 Daltons, which is just in a small, short oligomer, less than DP30, barely what I would even call a polymer. The challenge is that if you look at how the polymer was made for the better part of 25 years, it was a very classical step growth polymerization. So using every sophomore organic chemistry trick you could ever dream of, here I show diethyl fumarate and propylene glycol. You can heat, you can pull vacuum, you can use Lewis acids, different catalysts. But at the end of the day, this is a very energy intensive process. You've got a lot of side reactions that go on. You get uncontrolled polymer properties where the molecular mass distribution is 2 or greater at best. The bigger problem for commercialization is using this on day 3 of polymer chemistry I teach. If you look at conversion versus molecular weight, if you want short chains, the conversion is extraordinarily low. You know, 20 or 30% at best, I think, was the best they'd ever got with fractionation. And unless it cures cancer, it's almost impossible to commercialize a material with that low of yield, especially since the biggest challenge and probably the most expensive thing to do in commercializing medical-grade polymers is getting rid of the residual. When you've got 70% residual monomer, it's a problem. It's expensive to remove, and pretty soon you're out of commercial relevance. And so while this had worked at the batch scale, 25, 50, even 100 gram scale was superhuman effort over 20 years. They really, there wasn't a path forward. Many, many companies passed on this. Jeff Coates has been a good friend of mine for a long time. In 2011, he published a paper in JAX with Angela DeCiccio, who's now Verily at Google, where they were doing chain growth polymerization. And Jeff has been focused on cheap monomer feedstocks for a long time for his sustainable and a CEF center. But basically, they're taking maleic anhydride with propylene oxide under catalytic conditions, doing a ring opening polymerization. Now, this is exciting for two things. One, there's nothing cheaper than maleic anhydride and propylene oxide. You make shampoo from this. You make tire parts from this. Okay, so cheap community feedstocks. More importantly, the mild conditions are nice, but it's atom economical. And so in that ring opening process, you're not kicking off any byproducts. If you're not kicking off any byproducts, you can drive things to very high conversion, and you don't have to remove the small molecule residuals. You also get, under ideal conditions, controlled polymer properties. So you can control the chain length and the chain length distribution very precisely. And our thought when we got into this was, if you could control the chain length distribution, you should be able to predict for resorption, which people have talked about for a long time, but nobody's actually shown that that's done. Now, commercially, these kind of things are reproducible. And if you want to go from 100 grams to 100 kilograms, that's the kind of thing. The batch record control is what's actually critical for regulatory processes. And so we started with some really what I call poor catalysts, but we'll move on quickly, with magnesium ethoxide. So we started with this because magnesium is a common transition metal that you find in a lot of biological processes at small quantities. And the ligand here is ethoxide, and so the terminal oxidation product is ethanol. Which I'm sure college students aren't immune to. The process here, when you do the ring opening polymerization here in toluene, which is actually a great processing solvent, you get the cis isomer, which is not cannot be photopolymerized, and you have to convert the cis to the trans using a base. But this can be done at very high fidelity, and we showed in this initial work, which we were excited about, but looking back, it's not all impressive now, is if you look at the long polymerization times, which for a catalyst person, this would be a dead project. But if you want to make something on a 100 kilogram or 1,000 metric ton scale, that's actually fine. The temperatures are all subcritical to toluene reflux. The yields here are pretty low for this particular catalyst, but now we're in the mid-90s. But you can actually march through and increase the chain very slowly by looking at a precipitation, or actually a precipitation molecular weight, 1.5 or so, so it's not great. But you'll see as the chain goes from 700 Dalton, which was a DP 5 or 6, where you've got a very low TG, as that increases up to 3,000 or so, you start to march very closely towards a room temperature solid.
That's another high molecular weight.
Very low molecular weight. Yeah. And it's got to be 3,500 Daltons or less. So the challenge in a ring opening process with really efficient catalysts is they're typically so fast that you can't make a oligomeric material. So I'll show you that in a minute. But what we were able to demonstrate with this initial oligomeric short material is that here's a really simple study we published last year with David, is if you start looking at two different structures, these are gyroid structures we've used for a long time, with 200 micron struts, 700 micron pores, and double that. This has roughly double the surface area as this one. These are 12% solid, 80% porous. This is an accelerated degradation test where you look at days and time versus mass loss, and you can see when you've got high surface area and short chains, they degrade very quickly. And even a few DP longer, 2,500 versus 15, if you go to the core structure, they degrade very slowly. And so one of the other challenges in some of these more complex defect repairs is if you wanted to design structures that parts would degrade quickly and parts would degrade slowly, so you could transfer biomechanic load versus time, which should facilitate the bone healing, most of what's been out there in the literature has been isotropic. And so the solution here is, okay, you should be able to design whatever you wanted, you know, and just do a surface area design. But that's, in fact, not true. And so David doesn't like when I show this slide, but this is really what we're calling the inconvenient truth in all of this, is that if you look at VAT photopolymerization, and it's the same as true if it's top-down versus bottom-up. If you look at complex viscosity, this is angular frequency, this is 1,100 Dalton, 1,700 Dalton, 2,000 Dalton. So very short oligomeric chains. Blue is room temperature plus 10 plus 10, so 25, 35, 45. So as temperature increases, viscosity drops. Okay, this is three parts, the solid symbols here, three parts polymer, one part diethyl fumarate, which is a reactive diluent, which serves as a solvent but is also incorporating the network. And down here is what you get in a typical resin formulation, which is 50-50, 50 polymer, 50 solvent. If you do what's out in the literature and what we've done in our own work, so we'll call the gray or blue box here as it shows up. This is the printable range. So if you want to print effectively, structures that are 200 to 300 microns or even smaller with similar sized pores, as you're pulling out of this bed, the capillary force on this structure is so high that you'll get fracture if you're not in this blue box. Okay? The more solvent you put in, the less resorbable the material is. And I'll show you that in a minute as well. And you can only accomplish that at 3:1 if you drop, increase the temperature to 45 C or higher, which is all right, but you're starting to approach the vapor pressure of some of the solvents, or try and drop the viscosity. Because the truth is, at 50% solvent, this will never be commercialized, ever. Simply because the FDA's guidance document last year came out and said the person who prints it, who owns the printer, is responsible for the liability. And so 5 or 6 years ago, when every hospital in the country was building two surgical suites with a printing suite in between them, and they were going to own the printers, and this is the way the hospitals were going to make money, now none of them are doing that. They're all going to a CVS pharmacy model, where some LLC is going to occupy that space. And I can describe that more ad nauseum. But the translational problems are here. Okay, so if you think translationally, the barriers are really distributed printing is not viable at 40 to 50% solvent. Okay, simply because you've got to get rid of it all, you've got to insure it all, you've got to sterilize those materials. And then if you've got that much solvent, and I'll show you in a minute, those actually solvent molecules are incorporated in the chain and you're forming carbon-carbon crosslinks, and those are not resorbable. Okay, and the FDA guidance document again suggests the liability will be who owns the printer. Technically, okay, if the viscosity is too high, capillary force will strip it from the build plate and you'll have failure after failure after failure. We've shown, and it's now known, there's a narrow window for resorption in vivo, and how do you alter structure to really target that? And then printing process destroys all drugs and biologics, either due to solvent or photochemistry. And so how do we build in reactive handles to accomplish that? And so probably the easiest model to show you is actually this one, where the blue is the oligomeric PPF chain, and these are diethyl fumarate. And you can see if you've got large amounts of this, this actually facilitate cross-linking between the individual chains. You also, in some cases, get homopolymerization of the DEF in there. And as the DEF fraction goes up, the amount of DEF between the chains gets longer. And if anything smaller than about 7 nanometers RH will come out of your kidneys, but if it gets larger than that, it doesn't take too long for that to happen, you're going to get stuck somewhere. Okay? It may degrade, but it may not resorb. And so the other challenge is then is you have to have a clear formulation. And so if you're going to print very fine structure, the UV absorption cross-section or light absorption cross-section and the wavelength that you're actually printing has to be small enough that it doesn't scatter light and cause deformation of your structure. And so really going forward, what I'll talk about in the next maybe 10 minutes or so as we finish this up is our real efforts to actually design resins that have low cross-section, low viscosity, and really allow us to reduce the amount of DEF. I won't go into this today, but we actually did a tour de force in magnesium catalysis for about 2.5 years. And so we did every class of magnesium catalysis that's out there. Some of this will finally get published this year after all the IP's in. But we've done BDI ligands, phenylates, which work great, bimetallic systems, and pyrrolizole. Some of these make really nice, elegant materials, but really are hard to scale. What we settled on was actually a BHT catalyst. And I was fortunate, James Wilson came to my group from Andrew Dove in the UK, and he had done BHT materials, magnesium-based. And the reason these were interesting, again, magnesium-based, but BHT is used as a common antioxidant in food packaging. And while there are some indications of sensitivity, we're at very low mole fraction catalyst, but they had shown for lactone polymerization, this actually worked great. It had not been shown for ring opening copolymerization of anhydrides and epoxides, but in fact, with some effort, it works quite well. So again, in toluene at 80 degrees C, using functional initiators, here's a group of maybe 3 of a dozen or so we have, you can actually, again, under very quick conditions now, generate the cis isomer and with the base condition isomerized to the trans, which is photoprintable. It's nice and slow, okay? So you can actually, we've done this 20-liter reaction even in my own lab, but over a couple of hours, you can actually start to generate reasonable molecular materials. Here you see, even at low conversion now, where we're looking at kinetics, you have molecular mass distributions that are even more narrow than what we had previously and very linear growth kinetics. And that's maintained all the way to high conversion. Probably translationally, what's been exciting is that when you do one precipitation, this is the kind of mass distribution you get. So this is a MALDI mass spectra where you have really only two populations. You've got the primary population where you get one initiation, and then you end up with one more propylene glycol in a second distribution. But what this says is using propargyl alcohol as the initiator, you have complete end group fidelity. And so if you wanted to take this forward to a regulatory body and actually show them, and this is what we've shown them, this is the best possible scenario for translating this material into a device. What we were able to show in a paper early last year was that if you actually use that propargyl alcohol as an initiator and go through the polymerization process, if you then come back, and again, this is our traditional 50-50 mixture, so we don't change too many variables at once, you can actually print scaffolds. These are what we're using for mouse cranial implants. And you can come back after the scaffold's been printed, after the scaffold's been sterilized, and functionalize it either with peptides, and we've done maybe a dozen now here, we have RGD, or photochemical groups, and you can actually pattern those groups on the surface, and you can control the concentration very precisely. Now, what's been really fun now is actually printing scaffolds where you might actually come back and do the defect. And a couple of hypotheses we're trying to test here is, one, can you control resorption rate with structure? And the second is, can you control resorption rate with chain length? And so here we're printing, this is a DP7 scaffold. This is about 1,000 Daltons. And it's an oligomer, not a polymer, but you've got about 250 micron struts, about 450 micron pores, and you've only got a couple of print layers. And you can see here in the SEM, you've got nice rough surfaces, which should be great for osteoblasts when implanted. These do not have any biologics in them or on their peptides on them. This is DP7, this is DP11. You might say that that's not that different, but I'll show you that the outcomes are actually significantly different. If we now go to a rat cranial defect model, and this is done in my own lab, I've got a really talented orthopedic resident and lab manager that can actually do this surgery. So we did a couple hundred rats. This is a preoperative where you actually split the skull in a Wister rat. With 12 millimeters, you drill out a hole, you preserve the membrane underneath. You can drop the scaffold in, and at 1 month, you start to see, you don't see the scaffold there. That's actually the mineralized bone growing in around the scaffold. And it's always split here because there's a large vein that runs at the focal point of these skull defects. But if you look at the H&E and the Sanderson stain, red here is new lamellar bone, and you'll find no evidence of inflammation. Okay. And at about 1 month, 70% has been filled. And if you look at a whole population, you see even though this is 1,200 and this is 1,800 Daltons, so only 600 Daltons different, basically three or four repeat units. And all that does is tell you how much more cross-linking is in there. You see that at 1 month versus 3 months, that this lower molecular weight, which was resorbing faster, is actually the bone is growing into a much greater extent. Now, it does catch up at 3 or 4 months, but if you start looking at statistics, where you have hundreds of data points in this particular box plot, so this is the DP7 at 4 weeks, this is the 11, you can see that there's significantly more bone volume growing in, but that does catch up with time. And so now we're looking at how do you control that anisotropically, and actually, can you predict degradation? And so these are two different experiments here. This is an in situ, and this is actually a strut thickness loss with time. And you see very linear-like, almost surfing resorption-like degradation from these fine struts in these 3D printed materials. And so while that's, we'll save that for a different day. We're working on a computational model with my colleague, Andre Dobrynin. I think the histology will at least convince you. So this is a H&E, again, in yellow here, and red are two different struts. So this is the polymer strut, this is the lamellar bone, this is the woven bone around, and it's a little easier to see in the Sandersons that you've got some pretty interesting phenomena going on here, and because of time, I'll basically highlight here. So not only are you getting osteocytes and actually vascularization in the lamellar bone, which is really critical to predicting if it's actually going to resorb and heal, you get osteoid seams on many of the corners of these structures, which suggests that the material is being eaten from that particular side. And so now we're actually looking at different structures rather than smooth gyroids to predict anisotropic degradation of these structures. But you see osteoblast, osteoclast, and more importantly, very little indication of inflammation or something that would lead to an inflammatory response that would lead to failure. The challenge has really been trying to predict how much is actually needed. So here the scaffold was clearly too thick at 245 microns. But what you'll see is at 1 month, if you start to go back and actually quantify the struts, we've lost about 20% of the struts at 1 month. And so now we're trying to finish up this quantification and get it out. Does it matter if it's there 3 months, 12 months, if it eventually goes away? Maybe not, but I think the early indications are that it's going to be challenging if you don't actually get the material to go away. And the proof in that is really here. So this is a mandible bite wing experiment that we did in a dog at Ohio State Plastic Surgery with David Dean. Here you have it in silico. Here you've actually printed it in a model that we're using. So the Iacuc actually made us use 3,500 Dalton material, which was very difficult to print because the viscosity was high and the amount of diluent we needed was significant. And this is 10 months in a dog. This is a mandible in the other side that's not 3D printed. Here we have a three-dimensional structure. We had a flat structure. And you see where the periosteal flap was, you actually form bone. But at 10 months in vivo, at that molecular weight, the scaffold's still there. And I would bet a year from now it'd still be there because you get to a point where you've got so much carbon-carbon bond formation that it's not going away. And so the challenge really now going forward is how do you design chain structures that where you drop the viscosity so you can drop the sol fraction. And so over the last year, we've really come up with a huge family of resins where this is the original material we published in JAX early last year, but now we're able to make block copolymers. We do functional epoxide PPF, where if you want to do pro-drug strategies, we've just reported the synthesis of freestanding structural gels, and very soon we'll have random copolymers and stars. And so all of these molecules are designed to not only control chain length, but enable post-polymerization functionalization, and ultimately cut the viscosity. Now, maybe show you one example here as we're out of time. So block copolymers have been a great adventure. But if you start to make now block copolymers of different lactones, some of these you'll recognize, like epsilon caprolactone or valerolactone. These are some other exotics. This is a gamma methyl and an epsilon methyl. But if you just look at, ignore all the time and conversion, all that thing, if you start to look at some of these functionalized caprolactones, which are known not to crystallize, you can actually use the lactone block in combination with a PPF and use the lactone as a sacrificial carrier. And here you'll see that's gamma methyl caprolactone, even though the molecular weight's now 10,000 Daltons higher than the printable PPF, the room temperature, the TG is almost minus 20 C. So a great way to reduce viscosity. And in fact, if you take this now, this is our 20-liter reactor we have in our lab, and if you start to look at the complex viscosity again versus frequency with this particular gamma methyl epsilon caprolactone, so the solid block here is pure polymer, 50% dilution, pure polymer, 50% dilution. This is the molecular weight. This is a DP of PPF. We're at DP9. That's right between where we were in 7 and 11. And you can see here in the green that we're at 3 to 5 Pascal seconds right away. So allowing us to use a longer chain, less of it, but require a carrier. The carrier you do have to etch out. If you start to do some copolymerizations with succinic anhydride and maleic, you can get around that as well. And so I misused my time a little bit. But I think, hopefully, and if anyone has questions, I'd be glad to go in it, but I want to be respectful of people's time. I think the first part of the talk really showed that if you think differently about how you actually want to do the repair, there's materials out there that might work. And so we've been now translating that out into a startup company. We're making wrist plates and bone pins and bone putty and other things before we do the exotic repairs. I think in the PPF particular application I talked at the end, there's significant preclinical data out there by more than 80 different groups worldwide who says that this potentially could work if there was a source material. But the materials availability has stifled innovation. And I think when I talked to Tony Mikos the first time when he saw this, we made a 10-kilogram batch of PPF not too long ago. And that was the entire amount of PPF his group made in the first 10 years he was working on that project. And I think we did it in about 3 days. And so I think that the solution and engineering solution for that at scale is there, and that material can be available. I think science-wise, I think the ability to predict and design for degradation will be absolutely critical in regenerative medicine in these types of applications. You can't rely on bulk degradation if you want to do things with really fine structure or where you've got vascular applications where acidity is going to be a challenge. I think the post-functionalization is also going to be significant. So I didn't show that today, but now we're looking at different tethered growth factors and pro-drug strategies to try to tamper Different biological functions are actually promote bone healing in some indications. But for 3D printing, they've ignored a lot of that because the light and the solvent destroy a lot of those biologics. If you can put those on either after in package or actually in the OR, I think that's a distinct advantage. And now we're working with David Dean and Mike Miller, who's the chair of plastic surgery at Ohio State, on a first-in-man orbital fracture model in elderly patients. But I think the opportunity for materials, hopefully today, and new materials is really clear. And so I've been really fortunate, again, at the University of Akron. Some of the folks in red are this is my group. Some of the folks in red contributed to the work I talked about today. Some of the early work was funded by the Third Frontier, which is an innovation platform. Later funded by the DOD. The PPF work has been funded largely by a startup company, 21 MedTech, and the Gerald Austin Endowment, and critical partnerships both with Brad and Annie at Methodist, and David and Mike at Ohio State have been critical to advancing this. And I've got a group now of 25 or 30, probably two-thirds chemists, one-third everything else, engineers, BMEs, biologists. But I think really trying to do big things can't be done on your own. And so probably two-thirds of my funding, two-thirds of my activities are really collaborative. And most of them have been with engineers or surgeons. But I think if you can find the right partner, the right ecosystem, there's really no limit on what you can do. And so thanks again for making time this morning to come. I'll answer any questions that I can. And I look forward to meeting many of you today and tomorrow. So thanks.
Questions? You off the chemistry question?
Sure.
Okay, so if you can go back to your slide where you did the tuner report of the magnesium catalyst.
Yes.
Very, very nice. You know, this is exactly what I think a polymer chemist should be doing regardless of the application. But there are a number of criteria I think that are important to you. So one is polymerization efficiency, one is going to be biocompatibility, magnesium is, but I don't know about the ligands, one's going to be material processing. I'm wondering if you can comment on each one of those with regard to matching the catalyst to those kind of.
The metal is more of a problem than the ligand. So most of our catalysts are done at half or more 1%, and because the polymer chain is strong, it's not as sticky as if you make a long chain polymer with a catalyst, it's very hard to get rid of the catalyst. Because this is still solution processable, it's not so bad. So much of what Jeff has done has been with cobalt or chrome, which are the two worst metals, or even tin, two or three worst metals you could ever dream of. But in fact, with magnesium, the terminal oxidation product here is magnesium oxide. So once you do an acid wash, it turns the oxide. Magnesium oxide is actually used as a filler in most vitamins, so you eat it almost every day. The BHT ligand is found in every clear plastic food packaging that you're using. And really, that's what drove us to that. If you actually use the phenolates here, far better control over chain and chain distribution properties at even lower catalyst concentration. But that phenolate has been more difficult to remove and probably more of a concern biologically than the BHT ligands.
So the BHT ligand with the double ferritin ring on the bottom, that's what you're talking about.
This is the one we're using.
Okay.
Yeah. No, it's a dibutyl. No. So the only place where we ever, probably the worst catalyst was we did lots of failed experiments. These pyrazole ligands don't respond very well to some of your basic biotesting. It's a little stickier. It's hard to get rid of, even with pretty exotic purification. And so it's not always about picking the best ligand that's the most efficient that you'd publish, that we're going to publish in papers. It's what can you actually do to get rid of, which is when you're purifying polymers is the most expensive thing you could ever do commercially.
Other questions?
I think making new polymers is a great thing because mm-hmm. new polymers, but when you talk about application, clinical application, mm-hmm. it's, as you say, chicken and egg thing.
Mm-hmm.
Company will not use it because to show long-term safety, you have to study clinical outcome for months and years.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a lot of time. Company don't want to use it. Therefore, company don't want to develop. It's just chicken and egg thing. So using new polymers is good, but how about utilizing existing polymers like PCL, which mm-hmm. is also, you know, doesn't produce acid or maybe as good?
All those things are fine. It just depends on the application, right? So there's a certain amount of risk and tolerance that a company has. If they've got a new application, they don't want to risk any other material, and so they don't. If you've got an application that those won't serve, and where we've made inroads, and so probably we've got quite a bit of industrial money with a number of companies. If you can take and fit into their existing product or product line or demonstration something simple, bone pin, bone screw. I mean, as simple as it gets. How that material might be better than what they have, then they'll listen. But if you reach too far, so if I brought when I brought the sheep to Stryker, they waved it off, even though one of my good friends was the lead there. Because it's a new application with a new material. So you've got to do existing applications with new materials. And I think there's plenty of indications out there where companies aren't happy with it's been our experience for sure, where companies have a product, they don't love it because surgeons don't love it, or there's unoptimal patient populations. You know, PLL plates worked great. They had a huge clinical study at the University of Florida 10 years ago on lactic acid plates. They worked great, except for about 8% of the population where they had a horrible severe reaction. And then they pulled them off the market, despite the fact that they were great for you know, 90%. So a few percent better there will go a long way. And I think once it's shown that you have a material master file or a drug master file on a polymer, where you've been through the external NAMSA 1093 studies, which we're populating now with some of these materials, then there's been no pushback because it's been external validation.
But PLJ has been the only degradable polymer used mm-hmm. for one reason. It has been used.
Yep.
And that's the only reason. It's a lousy polymer.
Yeah, it's a lousy polymer.
So producing new polymer, better polymer, mm-hmm. this is like 10 times better. Mm-hmm. Slightly better may not really make it into clear.
I'll show you. I can't. It's being recorded, so I'll show you stuff later where that's different. The biggest problem you've got with strain crystallizing materials is when you're processing things like drugs, can you control polymorph formation? Number one problem in pharmaceutics. They spend billions of dollars trying to use semi-crystalline polymers and suppress them into formulations that don't crystallize or will prevent the drug from crystallizing. What we've seen in some of our materials is that because of the strong hydrogen bonding nature of the urea group, we can actually do that with no additives. And if you can do that, you've eliminated a lot of your formulation problems, and now you're back into science of actually, can you design delivery with time with different physiologies?
Okay.